This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. The American way is not to lie, right? I mean, you know, it's just kind of intrinsic to reasonable political culture that if, as the leader of a country, or even as a politician, as a representative of people who elected you, you are negotiating with other people, other countries, other entities, that people know that your word is good. People should know that America's word is good, which means that our president's word should be good. And yet we have a guy in the White House who has lied over 2,000 times just in his first year in office that have been documented by the press. I mean, you know, major lies. And another one that apparently he knows he's doing this and delights in it. Another one that was outed this morning by the Washington Post. Last night, Trump was in Missouri meeting with a bunch of rich fat cats, and apparently one of them recorded his remarks. The Washington Post has those, and they're floating all over the internet now. And one of the things he said was that he basically lied to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau about whether the United States has a trade deficit with Canada. Trump thinks we have trade deficits with everybody. We actually have a trade surplus with Canada. We engage in a lot of trade with Canada, particularly from Canada's point of view. We're their largest trading partner. But they end up buying more from us than we buy from them. So we have a trade surplus with them. But Trump tells the story of, well, I said to Justin, we've got a deficit with you. And Justin says, no, you don't. You've got a surplus with us. And I said, no, you've got it. We've got a deficit. And so we sent somebody off to check it out. And a guy came back and he said, Canada has a surplus. However, if you add in energy and something else, I forget what it was, energy and timber, then we lose $17 billion a year. He just literally made that up. It's not true. It's not what OMB says. It's not what the Department of Commerce says. It's not what anybody says. Either Trump made it up, or Trump asked somebody for a statistic that would prove him right during the meeting, and somebody gave him a lie. But in either case, Justin Trudeau got lied to his face. Here's Donald Trump bragging about this last night at this fundraiser. Ah, okay. Here we go. Hang on just a second.
Trudeau came to see me. He's a good guy, Justin. He said, no, we have no trade deficit with you. We have none. Donald, please. Nice guy, good-looking guy, comes in. Donald, we have no trade deficit. He's very proud because everybody else, you know, we're getting killed with them. So he's proud. I said, wrong, Justin, you do. I didn't even know. Josh, I had no idea. I just said you're wrong. You know why? Because we're so stupid. It's impossible. And I thought they were smart. I said, you're wrong, Justin. They said, no, we have no trade deficit. I said, well, in that case, I feel differently. I said, but I don't believe it. I sent one of our guys out. His guy, my guy, they went out. I said, check, because I can't believe it. Well, sir, you're actually right. We have no deficit, but that doesn't include energy and timber. I'm talking about Canada. You don't have a timber company. And when you do, we lose $17 billion a year. It's incredible.
Right. It is incredible that the President of the United States would lie to the Prime Minister of a foreign country and then would go before a group of billionaires or wealthy people, let's say, and brag about it. And they would think it was funny. What does this say to any other foreign leader? This is, you know, it's a variation on Trump. Trita Parson and I were talking about this yesterday, and he actually had, a rational explanation for what Trump might be trying to do. I'm not sure. But, you know, basically, Trump is doing two things at the same time. He's saying to North Korea, we would like you to suspend your nuclear program. In exchange for that, we'll make an agreement with you. We'll make a commitment to you. And then he's saying, but, you know, when we asked Iran to suspend their nuclear program and we made an agreement with them and a commitment to them, we're going to tear that up. We don't care. Yes, they're in compliance, but so what? We don't like what they're doing. And, you know, if you're Kim Jong-un, you're looking at this going, I mean, just like back when George W. Bush in 2002 said, you know, that the axis of evil was Iraq, North Korea, and Iran, And immediately, Iran and North Korea got nuclear weapons, and Saddam Hussein said, oh, I'm not the axis of evil. I'm just writing a romance novel, three-part romance novel, which he was, actually. That's what Saddam Hussein was doing, writing some, you know, lurid version of the Tales of the Arabian Nights or something. And he let the inspectors come into his country, and they searched high and low and all over, and Scott Ritter and Hans Blix, and you remember all that, and everybody said, nope, he's got no weapons of mass destruction, and Bush said, well, I'm going to bomb him back to the Stone Age anyway. And we destroyed their country. And by the way, Larry Kudlow, who's going to be Bush's new economic advisor, he went on television back in 2002 and said, you know, if we invade Iraq, it's going to be a big economic help for the United States. He also, in 2007 and early 2008, as we were sliding into the worst recession since the Great Depression, said, oh, everything's going to be fine. You know, keep buying stock. It's all good. Anybody who followed Larry Kudlow's advice got wiped out. Brilliant. But back to Trump. This, you know, lying to Justin Trudeau is a huge deal. I mean, this, if can you imagine if Barack Obama had been caught in a lie to a foreign leader? They would be having impeachment hearings right now. Or Bill Clinton. I mean, the Republicans are so selective in their outrage. It is absolutely astonishing. There's a lot of other things in the news today that I want to get to. We're going to have some interesting conversations, too. Richard Wolff will be with us. Bernie might be with us. Let's see here. We're going to check in with Evan Greer, campaign director of Fight for the Future, and find out what's going on with net neutrality as we go through the 3 hours of our program today. But an interesting piece over at Scientific American. It's by Martin Sismar. Oh, this is the raw story version of it, actually. And the headline is White Men Stockpile Guns Because They're Scared of Black People and Feel Inadequate, says science. And the article, you know, just comes right out and says it. These are men, this is quoting from the Scientific American article, these are men who are anxious about their ability to protect their family. You know, who are that 3% of Americans who own half of the guns in this country, right? The people who own lots and lots of guns, who are they, that 3%? These are men who are anxious about their ability to protect their families, insecure about their place in the job market, and beset by racial fears, right? Scientific American. They tend to be less educated for the most part. They don't appear to be religious, and suggests one study, faith seems to reduce their attachment to guns. In fact, stockpiling guns seems to be a symptom of a much deeper crisis in meaning and purpose in their lives. These people were emotionally and morally attached to their gun. They were 65% male and 78% white. Quote, we found that white men who have experienced economic setbacks or worry about their economic futures are the group of owners most attached to their guns. This is one of the Baylor sociologists. He said those with high attachment felt that having a gun made them a better and more respected member of their communities. The sociologist said the gun is the ubiquitous symbol of power and independence. I would say it's also a phallic symbol. Well, in fact, he goes on, guns therefore provide a way to regain their masculinity, which they perceive has been eroded by increasing economic impotency, or impotency, or however you say that word. You know, we started this thing called the Small Penis Gun Club, and somebody else has a version of it over on Facebook. And smallpenisgunclub.net.org.com redirect to various places. And, you know, kind of making fun of those men. This article says that's really the wrong way to do it. When you make fun of them, you make them crazier. You make them worse. What we need to do is figure out why they feel so impotent. And obviously the reason, in large part, is economic. It's 37 years of Reaganomics has ripped apart the American dream, the American compact, the expectation that you can get ahead, in particular for the white men who were the principal beneficiaries not only of a good economy back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, but also of their own white privilege. And now that white privilege is being challenged, and the economy is falling out from underneath them, and they're freaking out, and they're pointing at people of color as the objects of their pain. And to, you know, and to prove how that's going, Joe Madison sent me a link to this amazing article. This is over at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This is a school district in Minnesota. The Oconomowoc Area School District is limiting discussions about social privilege after a Martin Luther King Day exercise that touched on the subject of white privilege set off a firestorm in that predominantly white community, writes Ansia Johnson for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The superintendent of schools is Roger Rindo, and he said, quote, schools are a microcosm of their communities, and we had parents in our community who felt like the concept of privilege went a little far, particularly for some of our younger students. A parent in the school district, Amanda Hart, says, I don't know how you can have a discussion about race without discussing privilege to give our students a complete picture. She says, even if you don't agree with the concept of white privilege, it's part of helping students become critical thinkers. At least you talk about it, right? Well, apparently, no. Apparently, in that school district, they're saying, no, we're not even going to talk about it. So, you know, all kinds of strange stuff in the news today. But Donald Trump admitting, not just admitting that he, quote, makes up facts, but bragging about lying to a foreign leader. This is astonishing. Meanwhile, the Mueller investigation continues. Paul Manafort's trials and tribulations continue. It's getting strange out there. When is he going to lash out against this?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Will be the moment of maximum danger for our republic is the moment that Donald Trump feels that he or his family members are actually in danger. And welcome back. Let's see here, John in Vernon Hills, Illinois, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Great to talk to you again, sir.
Thank you.
I first of all, I have a question and then an opinion.
Okay.
The question is, other than voting the mostly criminal party out, is there any other way that we can reduce their impact?
Voting is, you know, is clearly the final product of everything. But along the way, yeah, I think the way you reduce the impact of things like, you know, the Fox propaganda channel, what they're on MSNBC, they're calling Trump TV, right-wing hate radio, things like that. The way that you reduce their influence is by exposing people to a counter-narrative, to another story, to the other side of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. And
right. And
that, I think, means telling your friends about Free Speech TV, telling them about, you know, websites like Alternet. I've got a new piece up there today, Truth Out, Common Dreams, you know, the progressive websites. Signing up with groups like Indivisible or whatnot, you know, Our Revolution, things like that, and trying to get other people involved in that. Does that answer your question, John?
Yes, to the most part, Tom. And the other thing is I am so proud of the young people that took off from school and are really
after. You turn them up a little, Sean. I can hardly hear.
Assault weapons. They are fabulous, and they are our future.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. John, thank you very much for the call. Very, very well said, and totally agree with you. Al in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Al, what's up?
How are you today?
I'm well. I hope you are, too.
I think you're touching on something, Tom, that we as Democrats have to stop attacking Trump every day, nonstop. Joe Scarborough, nonstop.
Well, Joe Scarborough is a Republican, or at least was.
Well, yes, but he claims to have registered as an independent, but
right.
it's not just him. It's Rachel Maddow. It's CNN, you know. Well, you know, everybody from Rachel
so
Maddow.
So you want us to do like Fox News does, like all day yesterday they just pretended that the school shooting walkout didn't happen, right?
No,
it just didn't show up on the news on
that's
Fox.
That's not what I'm saying. I think we need to point out what you just pointed out, and that's the fact that new boss is the same as the old boss. George Bush resembles everything what Donald Trump has already assembled.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
It's just that George Bush did it with a little bit of class and he knew how to handle the media.
Well, I don't care how you get screwed. You get screwed by somebody that's, you know, doing it and they're being smart about it. But
yeah, Reagan did it with full Hollywood, you know. I mean, it was just.
Right. Well, Reagan was a little bit different, though. You have to admit. But Bush was a special kind of person because, you know, he can hide under the spotlight now because, you know, every day all you hear is Trump.
Yeah, you've got Republicans actually nostalgic for George W. Bush, which is bizarre. And I've even heard Democrats say that, which is even more bizarre. Al, thanks for the call. Good points all. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV on your cable system there. We'll be right back. It's coming up on 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. One other thing I wanted to point out to you, the Fox News channel yesterday on multiple occasions, and MSNBC did a great segment on this morning. It's over on Media Matters. I'm sure as the day goes on, it's going to migrate all over the internet and various news sites. Kept repeating the lie that Trump said that Conor Lamb ran as a Republican. In fact, Paul Ryan essentially said this. Yeah, the fact that Conor Lamb didn't explicitly support an assault weapons ban, which would have been unpopular in his district because some hunting rifles would fall under that ban, and there's a lot of hunters in rural Pennsylvania and whatnot. So he didn't explicitly support that. But Conor Lamb campaigned for universal health care. It's right on his website. Healthcare should be a right, not a privilege. He campaigned against Donald Trump's tax cut. He said it was a giveaway to rich people, and it was screwing the average person. He campaigned for expanded background checks with regard to guns. So he is in favor of, strengthening our gun laws. He campaigned, most importantly, for stronger unions. The Republican Party has been on a tear against unions ever since 1935. Reagan's signature achievement was destroying America's union movement. And Conor Lamb campaigned for stronger unions. He campaigned against Republican cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Conor Lamb campaigned for a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. And he campaigned for medical marijuana. That makes him a what? As far as I can tell, that makes him a Democrat and very close to being, if not, a progressive Democrat, a pragmatic progressive Democrat. And yet, you got Trump lying about this. You've got Fox News lying about this. You've got Paul Ryan lying about this. Literally, the story that Republicans are telling themselves right now, and I'm sure right-wing hate radio is doing it too, is that, oh, yeah, that Conor Lamb guy, he just ran as Republican light, and that's why he got elected. Just stick with the Republicans. Well, you guys, keep telling yourselves that. And people like Conor Lamb, who are actual Democrats and hold actual progressive policy positions, are going to keep winning elections. And they're going to keep activating people because the people in this country know what's going on. We're not stupid. We can see what's going on. So all that said, Stephanie in Kankakee, Illinois. Hey, Stephanie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, what's on my mind was just what you were saying, basically. People think it was a lot of things that got Trump in office. And one was that people said he spoke like us. We live in a media world where people want to surround themselves in a bubble with only people that believe what they want to believe, and they'll lie and make up stuff. I mean, all week, it's marching, and yesterday these grown adults were trolling these young people, and making up stuff. One person said that there was a big riot in Stockton, and they tore up the Walmart. And I'm like, okay, well, show me where that happened. Show me, because the Stockton police said it was, smooth. But they said, well, if I believe it, I'm going to believe it, and I'm going to post it. And if you have the president lying to another statesman from another country because he wanted an agenda pushed through that he felt he needed, where is our country going to if this is what our leader is doing? And that's why they voted on him, because it didn't matter if he's wrong. As long as he did what they wanted him to do, and if he had to lie to get what they needed him to get, they accepted it.
Yeah, this is basically the evangelical argument. We don't care what kind of man he is. We still think Jesus would love him. It's bizarre. It's just bizarre. Stephanie, you've identified it really, really well, and thank you for the call. You said it very well. And where is our country headed? Into a crisis. That's the problem. I mean, we are on. I wouldn't say on the brink of nuclear war with either Russia or China, but we could be pushed into it in a matter of days. I mean, both those relationships are so fragile, not to mention North Korea and a few others.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
And when we need a real, you know, John Kennedy, Cuban Missile Crisis, cool head in the White House, we get Donald Trump? Oh, my God. Save us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just another example. By the way, I wrote a piece that's over on alternet.org right now about, you know, a government of billionaires and oligarchs, how Jimmy Carter said we're an oligarchy, not a democracy, with unlimited political bribery. The proof of this is Mike Pompeo rising to the top after, you know, giving a daily tongue bath to Donald Trump since he decided that instead of having a professional CIA briefer provide the president's daily brief, that he would do it himself, you know, et cetera. You know, learning how to suck up to oligarchs seems to be the skill set necessary in this White House. On the line with us, Senator Bernie Sanders, our old friend of the show, sanders.senate.gov, of course, his website. You can tweet him at Senators at S-E-N Sanders or at Bernie Sanders. Senator, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Tom. How are you?
I am great. Back in January, you did a town hall, as I recall, you know, on Facebook and whatnot, on Medicare for All, and got millions of viewers and participants. You've got another one coming up?
We do. On Monday night at 7 o'clock, we're going to be doing a live stream, and the topic is going to be the decline of the American middle class, the rise of oligarchy. It really is going to be a unique type of town hall, certainly one that is televised. We're going to have Elizabeth Warren on. We're going to have Michael Moore. I know you know Michael.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to have Derek Hamilton, who's a professor of economics and urban policy at the New School. I'm doing it for two reasons. Number one, as you well know, Tom, corporate media often does not focus on the main issues impacting working people throughout this country. And that's what I wanted to do here and get into some depth about why the middle class for 40 years has been in decline, why we have massive levels of income and wealth inequality, you know, why we are the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all or paid family and medical leave, why our kids are leaving college deeply in debt and others can't afford to go to college, what the decline of the trade union movement has meant to decent wages, what bad trade policies have meant to the deindustrialization of the country, et cetera, et cetera. So we got some great panelists. We're going to be focusing on extreme poverty, why the middle class has declined, and where do we go from here? How do we create an economy that works for all? So those are some of the issues.
That's marvelous stuff. I'm looking forward to that. That's next Monday?
That'll be Monday at 7 o'clock. It will be
Eastern time.
Held at Eastern time. It will be held at the auditorium at the Visitor Center in the Capitol, so anybody in the Washington area might want to come. And it will be live-streamed on my Facebook, on Michael Moore's, Elizabeth Warren's, Young Turks, and a bunch of ACTV, Now This, The Guardian. So we're going to have, I think, a very large viewing audience.
That's great. You should get Free Speech TV in on that one, too.
We'd love to. Anybody and everybody, we'd love to. And we'll continue to do these programs. We want to work with as many progressive outlets as we can. And the goal here is to really tell corporate media that the American people want serious discussion about serious issues, not just political gossip.
Right. And in the context of serious discussion about serious issues, while I have you here, what are you seeing as the biggest issues in front of us right now that we should be paying attention to, and in particular that we should be citizen lobbying our elected representatives over?
Well, there are a whole lot of issues that are out there that we're working hard on. I have a resolution that will be coming to the floor of the Senate, I think on Tuesday, maybe on Wednesday. It's a privileged motion, which demands that a vote be taken and will be taken on use of U.S. military force in Yemen. And the issue here, it may not seem like a very important issue, but it is, and not only because Yemen is right now as a result of a Saudi-led attack undergoing massive, massive suffering and a real humanitarian crisis. This is already a very poor country to begin with. But what I have sensed for many, many years is that the Congress has abdicated its constitutional responsibility to make decisions regarding war and given that over to presidents, whether they Democratic or Republican presidents. So, I mean, all of us who are old enough remember the horrors of Vietnam and other American military interventions. And what the Constitution is very clear about, it is that the Congress determines whether or not the United States gets militarily involved, goes to war, not the president. I want to reassert that authority and want to debate on Yemen. Obviously, the other issue that is on people's minds as a result of that terrible shooting in Parkland, Florida, is the need for gun safety legislation. And yesterday, I thought, was rather an extraordinary day in that young people from all over the country, including Washington, D.C., here in Vermont, came out onto the streets, and they said that it cannot just be the NRA that determines gun policy in this country, that there's sensible, common, sensible gun safety legislation supported by the vast majority of the American people, whether it's improving or expanding background checks, doing away with the gun show loophole, doing away with the so-called straw man provision, allowing people to legally buy guns and then selling them to people who shouldn't have them, or whether it's banning assault weapons. There is growing sentiment that we need Congress to act. Unfortunately, in Washington, the Republicans are beholden to the NRA, not to the American people. But that is a fight that has to be waged. I would say that health care remains a major issue. I think what they have discovered is in that special election in Pennsylvania, there was significant opposition to the Republican effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, throw millions of people off of the health care they have. As you know, I happen to believe that the United States should join the rest of the industrialized world and move toward a Medicare for all single-payer system. But health care remains a very important issue. High cost of prescription drugs is a huge issue. And, of course, the whole Trump presidency. We can go on for, 18 hours about that one. But, yeah. You know, stopping his effort to divide us up based on the color of our skin or the country we came from, or our sexual orientation, our religion, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So those are some of the issues that I've been...
On the walkout by the kids yesterday in school, here on Free Speech TV and Sirius XM Progress, progressive television, progressive radio. In fact, Free Speech TV is the largest progressive television network in the United States. It's 60 million homes, I believe, they're in. We covered it really well, but my understanding from the media overview I'm doing this morning is that Fox News, owned by billionaire Rupert Murdoch, basically pretended it wasn't happening. How do we get through to people who are living in the right-wing media bubble? Go ahead.
First of all, congratulations. You know, and I know that you and others. I think Nina Turner is also working in Free Speech TV.
Yeah.
And that's a very important part of what we need to do. And I know you've been doing this for years on your radio show. And I really do applaud you, because what we see with corporate control over the media is right-wing billionaires like Rupert Murdoch and others controlling major parts of television and radio. And you have areas in the United States of America where people are absolutely unfamiliar with the progressive ideas, which I think if they heard, they would be supportive of, but they're not hearing them. They're certainly not going to hear them on Fox. And I think, the answer, what I have been trying to do, Tom, is just visit many of the states that Trump has won. And I think that's what, national Democrats should be doing, is getting out there and talking to people in Trump land. I was just last week, as a matter of fact, I was in Texas. I went to a town called Lubbock, Texas. I don't know if you get this. Does the show get into Lubbock, Texas?
Yeah. Anybody with SiriusXM certainly can get us there. Anybody with the internet can get us there. Yeah. Anybody with Dish Network or DirecTV can get us there. So, yeah.
There you go.
We have listeners and viewers.
You have a town in Lubbock, Texas, city, which voted 2-1 for Trump, and yet you have 45% of the people either Latino or African-American, and the rest of the people, almost all of them, everybody, is working for really low wages.
You know?
So you got whites working for low wages, Latinos working for low wages, blacks working for low wages, and 2 out of 3 people there vote for Mr. Trump. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that people are not hearing what a progressive vision is about. So we had a great rally. We were in Lubbock. We had like 1,300 people out. We did a rally in San Antonio, just a huge turnout there. We did something in Phoenix, Arizona, also a great turnout. And, you know, what Democrats cannot continue to do is just spend their time on the East Coast and the West Coast. We got to get to the rest of the country, where I think when you talk about the need to raise the minimum wage to a living wage, talk about health care for all, you talk about asking, demanding that the wealthiest people in this country start paying their fair share of taxes, that we make public colleges and universities tuition-free, that climate change is not a hoax, but one of the great environmental crises facing the entire world. I mean, you talk about those issues, people will say, yeah, that's right, that's right. But they're not going to say, they're not going to agree with you, they don't know about it. So that's why we got to get out there through media and through personal appearances.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders, you've got a town hall coming up on Monday. You want to restate that real quick? And because I want people
it's
to show
be
up.
It's live streamed Monday night, 7 o'clock. It'll be on my Facebook page. It'll be on The Guardian, Young Turks, a whole lot of Facebook pages. I think people will find it very interesting discussion of income and wealth inequality in America and what that means for our country.
Sounds like a plan. Senator Bernie Sanders, thank you so much, Senator, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Keep up the great work.
You too, sir. It's always great talking with you. Thank you. We'll be back in just a few minutes with more of the news of the day and my take on it, your take on it, your calls, whatnot. In just a few minutes, be sure to check out Bernie's site, sanders.senate.gov, and, of course, ourrevolution.com, I think, is the more recent one. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's coming up on 14 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back here on the Tom Hartman program, helping you win the water cooler wars. And welcome back. Denise, watching Free Speech TV in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's on your mind today?
Well, first I want to say that I'm proud to be part of 2% of something, which is the Free Speech Comrades.
Oh, good. Well, thank you for being part of our family.
And I encourage anybody that's on a fixed income like we are to just make that monthly donation. You don't even miss it once you start doing it. We've been doing it for quite a few years now.
Yeah, and it doesn't need to be a large amount. Even, you know, $5 a month is a big deal to Free Speech TV if a lot of people do it, for example.
Yep. So that makes me happy. I feel privileged to be able to be part of your world.
Thank you.
The Michigan schools... The legislature in Michigan has voted to let the charter schools share in the taxes that the public schools get. So all of Betsy DeVos's lies and the way she's trashed our school system in Michigan is working. Now they're going to start sharing the money per student that the schools get with the charter schools.
This is a brand new event?
Yep, it happened within the last month.
Whoa.
The House voted it.
So basically what happened is that the charter schools are now being treated as fully public schools, period.
Right.
Even if they're for-profit, even if they're run by Scientology or the Wahhabis from Saudi Arabia, or even if
exactly.
they're, you know, whatever they may be.
Yep, exactly.
Remarkable.
Just wanted you to know that. And then the other thing we heard, Kimberly Clark, the big paper corporation that works a lot in the upper Wisconsin area, and a lot of Michiganders get to work, you know, across the border.
Right.
They got $768 million from this tax thing that Trump did.
Yep.
And they're laying off 5,000 people.
Well, of course, you know, take the money and run. That's
yep.
kind of the official, you know, oligarchic American business model strategy these days. And
yep. So
that's a terrible
schools
thing.
Are going, everything's going down, but we got to keep fighting.
Yeah.
So I'm proud to be part of the Comrades for Freedom.
There you go. Well, thank you very much, Denise. Great talking with you. I appreciate the call. Cassandra in Middleton, Wisconsin. Hey, Cassandra, what's up?
Hello, Tom Hartman. I want to say I am delighted to be a student in the Tom Hartman University.
Well, thank you. We just have a minute, though, so let's get right to your question or your comment.
Well, my comment here is that I attended my local Democrat county meeting, and one of the everyone is trying to understand why the Hillary vote and why Trump won Wisconsin. And Kathleen Vinholt, she is running. She's a state senator, and she's running for governor. And she has some very interesting statistics about it. And she cited that the voters who are voting in many of the gubernatorial races, all of these voters, a majority of them, they are qualitatively different. The Republican Party are very good at getting 90% of potential voters, whereas Democrats, we get roughly 72% of our potential voters. And so, and also on top of that, there is about 10 to 15% of those are newly registered voters who will vote one time and then they will drop off.
Yeah.
So, and I'd just like for you to comment on it after.
Sure. I think what we're seeing is I believe the voter suppression plays a big role in this. You know, there's 40,000 Wisconsinites who were not allowed to vote in the last election because they didn't have the right ID. And that was, less than Trump's margin of victory. Andy in Wilmington, Delaware. Hey, Andy, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's on your mind today?
Tom, earlier you mentioned a study about guns and self-image.
Yeah.
And I'm going to touch on that today. I know a lot of folks with guns, and I don't know anybody that has a serious self-image problem, but it definitely...
Andy, it wasn't so much self-image I was... frankly, ridiculing with a small penis gun club. It was more what they were saying was that people who are facing economic insecurity, people who are unsure about their ability to pay, to feed their families over the long term, pay the rent, pay the mortgage. Those are the folks, particularly when they're white, who tend and white people who have had very little contact in their lives with people of color and men. Those are the groups who tend to be part of that 3% of gun owners in the United States who own 50% of all the guns in the United States. That was the essence of the study.
Yeah, I get that. What I want to touch on is that group of people, if you're having tough times, you buy a gun, you're automatically a member of a club. You already have a group of people that will embrace you because you have a gun. And add to that the merchandising. Now, if you take a look at any gun magazine, Tom, or any compare it to a skiing magazine or a fishing magazine, you will find that first of all, R&D departments of every one of these gun manufacturers are trying to make these things more and more lethal, more and more sexy, more chrome, bigger calibers. And on top of that, go onto YouTube and watch how fast you can reload a handgun. You can learn how to do that on a handgun.
Sure. Well, and there's autoloaders, too, if you want to do it really fast.
You can.
Even with a revolver.
You can get a 30-round clip for a Glock, and you can actually train and learn how to do a quick reload. In other words, you can shoot off 60 rounds in 1 minute easy. If you just practice a little bit. So when you think about the fact that most shooters, for instance, in schools, are suicidal, they want to have a gunfight. They want somebody to engage. Besides just kids that are sitting there, you will give them that satisfaction if you got somebody else in there shooting back at them. But the fact is you can be just as lethal with a handgun. And I think a lot of the emphasis on the AR-15, whereas it's very a deadly gun, if you're able to shoot, 60 rounds a minute with a couple of clips.
This is why really... the assault weapons ban banned these large magazines and why we need to go back to it, number one. Number two, you can't be as lethal as you are with an AR-15 because of the way that the bullet impacts the body with an AR-15. It just rips things apart inside. in ways that you have to use special ammunition to get out of a pistol.
Add to that the Teflon bullet. You can buy legally a Teflon bullet.
Yeah. Yeah, these cop killer bullets and whatnot that they will even penetrate body armor.
I don't know how you're going to change people's minds when it comes to if I feel good because I own a gun. You have to be able to change that. You have to break that. I don't know how you're going to do that.
No, I get it. And I think that the way you do it is by changing culture. Right now, when somebody gets a concealed carry permit, they've got a gun in their car, or on their person, they're feeling pretty good. Hey, I got some protection. I'm I've got some power here. I've got authority, And instead, if that were in another culture, if that person were, in Great Britain, for example, they would be feeling like, whoa, I've got this really dangerous weapon here and I've got to take really good care of it and I've got to be really careful about it. It's like our media, and you're absolutely right about the gun magazines and the whole gun culture thing. I mean, as I've told the story a million times, I go back to Michigan for Thanksgiving, Christmas holidays and things like that, and my brothers and I go out shooting. There's a gun range down in Mason, just south of Lansing, and that we go to all the time. And there's a real sense of camaraderie among the guys there. And, we're all shooting enthusiasts and like that. And that comes out of culture. That comes out of, all the way back to when I was a little kid in the 50s. I mean, watching John Wayne and the Westerns, and the gunslingers and all that kind of stuff. That we have been kind of prepped for this. We've been trained for this. But I think that is not the case with the generation that walked out of school yesterday. I think that generation views guns completely differently from basically every other generation that preceded them. This is arguably the first generation to view guns right from the get-go. I mean, these kids who walked out last week were being born or were little kids around the time of Newtown. There's never been a time in their lives when there weren't mass shootings in schools. And they view guns as, existential threats to their lives. And so...
Tom, can I say one?
Yeah, we got 5 seconds, sure.
Okay, one thing. Those kids are acting in an act of self-preservation. No one is saving them. They've got to save themselves.
Yeah.
And that's why they're acting.
You're absolutely right. And I was talking with Louise about this last night. I said, during Vietnam, we were convinced that our government was trying to kill us, and they were. I mean, they killed 57,000 of us. These kids are feeling the same way, and I think just like our generation changed America because of Vietnam, I think these kids are going to change America and probably do it younger than I did.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.